Hey guys, just before we jump into the episode today, we would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which we record this podcast today. We pay our respects to the elders past and present, and we extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people here today. This episode is brought to you by the Psych Collaborative, our online psychology clinic bringing good quality, accessible therapy to you in the comfort of your own home. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode with the Psychology Sisters. My name's Amy and I'm a registered psychotherapist.
And I'm Kat, a registered psychologist. And together we are the Psychology Sisters, a podcast dedicated to normalizing the mental health conversation. Amy, my darling, sweet Amy, it has been a long time. It's been weirdly long since we've recorded our last podcast. Sorry, everyone. How are you, my dear? How's life? Talk to me. Give me the life update.
It has been a while. I feel oddly nervous.
Same. I got on the mic being like, how do I?
I'm how nervous. Do I podcast?
Sweating.
It has been a long time. I was reading this meme the other day that said something along the lines of, there are no greater trust issues like your favorite podcast going on hiatus.
And we are so inconsistent. We are the most emotionally unavailable podcasters you can find. I know. Was that on Shameless? They were like, we're just taking a 3-week break. We'll be back in exactly 3 weeks. You'll still have episodes. And I was thinking of ours, like, we just say, sorry, guys, we'll be back, like, not sure. We're like the absent father that you just don't know when they're coming home. Like coming home for Christmas. Hi, I'm here. And then you don't see them for 12 months. So apologies, guys. We are so inconsistent. We were supposed to record a few weeks ago, but a few things happened. But we're here. We've made it. Apologies that we are a little later than expected, but very excited. So, Aime, sorry, I just stole your how are you? How's life? Give me the update. How are you surviving in this freezing cold weather?
Look, I think I have three blankets on at the moment, some bed socks, three jumpers, you know, so we're rugged up and we're ready to go. And I feel like whenever someone asks me how I'm going, my general response at the moment is cold. Yeah. The weather is freezing and it is. Winter is not my jam. I'm not enjoying it. There have been floods and storms and
awful.
Nonstop rain, which has just meant motivation is a little bit low. I feel like energy becomes a little bit more flat. But other than that, not too bad. How have you been, dear Katniss? How was
other than feeling completely depressed, I'm fine. Everything's fine. Oh gosh.
Why don't you tell us all about your amazing sunny warm trip to Europe? Dying to know.
Wow. Tell me how you really feel.
Love you. Love you.
I had a few friends the other day saying, like, I have unfriended you. Like, not even just muted me. Like, they unfriended me because I was in Europe. I was like, wow.
Wait, unfollowed you or unfriended you? Like, sorry, we can't be friends anymore. Because
I think both. I think that's what an unfollow is. It's a way of saying, I've had enough of you. I have a few friends that I had to genuinely not just mute my stories, but unfollow me. And they haven't followed me back. And I'm like, I'm home now. Like, oh God, so sorry that I took a break. But no, it was
sorry that I was in sunny Spain with my Aperol spritz.
Is there a bit of resentment we need to work through, Hutto? No, it was absolutely wonderful. I was so excited to get over there.
Did you know what just came up? You know, in Bridesmaids, where she's like, oh, you do you?
What kind of name is Stove? Yes. So, yeah, I had a wonderful time. It was beautiful and sunny. I was drinking with some clients because COVID has forced me into this learned helplessness and this idea that nothing exciting happens or COVID postpones everything. I almost got to the airport like, oh, I'm not sure if we'll still go. Anything could happen. Like, I was genuinely expecting to just turn around and go home. But I didn't, which is so nice. It was just, yeah, it was so beautiful, so nice to get away and eat my way around Europe and have some sunshine and explore and travel and fill my cup and just be a kid. I always feel that with traveling. Traveling allows you just to have fun and not have to think about work. This is going to sound so lame, but I feel like people will understand. There's a certain type of person who'll understand this. Obviously, I was so excited for the traveling and the countries, but does anyone else feel this, Ames? I wonder if you did. I was so looking forward to the plane, being that the plane is the one place where no one can access you. You just sit there. You get fed. You get blankies. You get beautiful TV. You get six seasons of Gossip Girl. And you don't have to do anything or be anyone or go anywhere. I was so excited to sit on that plane and be like, oh my God, there is so much room for activities in the next 14 hours. So I was actually really looking forward to the plane and also the traveling, but gosh, just love a plane. Love sitting in the chairs, not having to do anything. But no, it was very wonderful. Very hard to come back though to this freezing cold weather. So it's been tough. Bit of post-holiday depression certainly settling in.
Oh, absolutely. Especially coming back to the freezing cold. But in all seriousness, so well deserved. You absolutely work your little tushy off and deserved a beautiful, sunny European break. So I'm glad that you got to take that time.
Even though... You're like, I'm so glad. I wish you guys could have seen that face. I was like, I'm so glad you took that time.
No. I do. Very, very well deserved. And I totally agree with the whole plane sitch, although sometimes I can get a little bit nervy on flights. I think whenever you have that space in between where you're inaccessible or it's kind of just like just being, yeah, nothing to do, no responsibilities, no obligations, just being.
Just floating in a metal container in the air, watching a lot of TV. It's brilliant.
So amazing.
Yes, Ames, talk to me about your pit and peak of the last six, seven weeks.
Okay, my pit has to be something that actually happened this morning. And okay. I feel like this will be really relatable for a lot of dog owners or just in general. I'm sure this has surely happened to people at least once in their life. So let me paint the scene for you. It's pouring down rain at about 6 a.m. Mowgli always needs to go to the bathroom when we first wake up. So I'm like, yep, cool, we'll go out to the bathroom. So I'm standing there, it's dark, it's raining, it's freezing cold, and I'm waiting for him to go to the bathroom. I see that he does a number two, so I'm like, oh crap, I don't have my bags. So I run back inside to grab my doggy bags to come back outside and pick up the poo. But because it was dark and raining, I couldn't actually see where the poo was. And so I'm walking around with my iPhone torch trying to look for this poo. And our next door neighbor had walked out, and so he got really, really excited and like ran off to say hello to the next door neighbor, who has a somewhat, I guess you could say, disdain for Mowgli because sometimes he can be a little bit loud. So I was like, oh no, like don't go and say hello to that person who doesn't like you at 6 a.m. on a rainy morning. Like this will not end well. And as I was trying to like frantically contain Mowgli, I looked down and realized that I was standing in the giant, smelly, soft poo that was still warm, might I add. Like it was stinging me in the cold rain.
Stop.
And I was just like, oh, this really couldn't get any worse. And then I had to walk over to like go and get him from the neighbor with shit all over my feet. And then the neighbor was like, are you okay? I was like, yeah, aww, like I'm fine, like morning, ha ha ha, the rain's out, okay, I'm just going to take my dog now. As I kind of did this shameful walk with like, you know, the empty doggy bag and the poo all over my feet. It's great.
Steaming poo.
Yeah.
There's nothing worse than someone taking pity on you as well. Like it's not just like, you know, the disdain. He moved past disdain and he was genuinely like, oh, wow, you are not okay.
It was secondhand embarrassment for sure. Like, you know, when something really embarrassing happens for someone else that you just feel so embarrassed for them. And it's like, oh, yeah. I look, you know, I'm not even going to draw attention to what's going on for you. I'm just going to give you like a gentle smile and off yeah. you go to clean your feet.
Yeah. Nothing more humbling than stepping in dog poo. No matter how old you are, no matter how many accomplishments you have in life, nothing humbles you and reminds you of humanness more than stepping in steaming, hot, slimy dog poo.
In the rain, in the dark, with your little flashlight and your poo bag out.
Oh, Ames, that's a real, real low point for you, I think.
It was. It was. Yeah, and it's the whole theatrics of like, you know, yeah. the darkness, the rain, like, yeah. you know, like rock bottom speaking.
But do we have a peak? Can we come back from that?
Well, let's bring it right on up. So my peak is that, also Mowgli related. Okay. Until my world revolves around my dog, which I'm not mad about. So for anyone that knows me and Mowgli, or Mowgli and I should say, knows that he has not always been the easiest dog to walk on the lead. Yeah, he's quite a pulley boy. He gets really excited. He's really big and strong. Like, he weighs 35 kilos. So he's a big boy. And I have really struggled to like fulfill this beautiful dream of sitting at a cafe, having a coffee with my really well-behaved dog. Instead, picture like utter chaos. Like me getting dragged. Like, he takes me for a walk. Okay. And like just getting dragged in diagonal lines across footpaths because he gets really excited at like birds that he'll see or other dogs that he'll see. So it's like I'm trying not to knock over tables and children whenever we go to a cafe. We have gotten to a point in our walking training and in our, you know, behavioral training that for the first time in a few months, I would say, that we have been able to do a really calm, like footpath walk to a cafe, get a cup of coffee, sit and wow. have a cup of coffee.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Ames, that is an incredible yeah. milestone. Congratulations.
Huge. Huge.
Mother of the year. Look at you. That's incredible.
Thank you. Thank you. My patience and my empathic presence, attunement, if yes. you will, has really stepped up. No, so on the weekend, I had such a beautiful Saturday morning. We went for a nice long walk and I was able to sit in the sun with a cup of coffee next to my dog and it was bliss.
Oh, everything you've dreamed of and more.
Yep.
Oh,
Ames, amazing.
That is a testament. I feel like you're underselling like how strong he is. Like he yeah. is, it's like a bull on a lead. Like, with all due respect.
I remember that time I brought him to your place and we went for a walk and you were like, oh, he's really strong as I'm like getting dragged off into the distance.
Like, because I was just like, I was worried. I was worried about your safety. I was like, is your shoulder okay? Like, are you going to get bursitis from this? I was a bit concerned.
You're like, do you need help? Oprah, Dr. Phil?
Yes, SOS. Oh, but well done. That takes incredible skill. So well done, you Ames. What a joy. It's a small thing, isn't it, to just be able to sit and slow down.
It is. It's a real journey. But nevertheless, what is your pit and peak? Give it to me.
Pit and peak. I will just say the whole Europe trip, I'm going to say a peak. All of it, lovely, amazing. Beautiful. I don't want to talk about it more because I feel I can see your seething hatred and I'm nervous to be to talk about it.
No,
it
was lovely, beautiful. I love that you got to get away.
No, I know. You're like, I love
Take
it.
Take me with you next time, but happy for you.
I said, come to Barcelona.
Imagine, Josh, if I gatecrashed your honeymoon. Imagine.
I think he probably would have welcomed it, to be honest. Yeah. Like, please, space and time. Okay, so speaking of Barcelona, I was in Barcelona, obviously, and whenever I visit different cities, I love to go to Zara. I love Zara. I love it in Australia, but I really, really love Zara overseas. Zara hits different. The overseas Zara, especially the European one, it is so much more colorful. The clothes are amazing. I just love it. Anyways, really, really humbling experience going to a Spanish Zara. I had all this pocket money saved up. I was like a kid. You know how you get like little 20s from your grandma at Christmas and you have like bits of pocket money and you save it up for a specific day of shopping or like there's a one thing you want to buy. I got to Barcelona and I was like, yes, I've got some spending money. I can't wait to like go to Zara and buy something really nice. Anyway, so I'm like an excited little kid. There's this beautiful like big Zara in Barcelona. I need to paint the scene. Barcelona was about 32 to 35 degrees. It was very hot and Barcelona is not really a windy city either. So it's that really sticky, humid heat. And Ames, you know what happens to my body when it gets hot, right?
We've
talked this through. It expands. I'm a great expanding woman in summer. Anyway, so it was quite hot. But anyway, I'm thinking, you know what? Don't care. Go into Zara, air condition. Air conditioner had broken, but that's fine. It didn't ruin me. I was just thrilled to be there in another country shopping. I go around, I pick up a few things. I think this is really cute. Love this. It's going to look amazing. Can't wait. Going to try it all on. I get to the change rooms. I have so many pits that revolve around change rooms, but I get to the change rooms. As I start to try on my first dress, I realize, whoa, the Zara sizing in Spain is vastly different to the Zara sizing in Australia. Spanish women are tiny. Hi. I'm not. And I'm thinking, oh, crap. I've just like taken in 10 items. Oh, gosh. Anyway, so I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to see how I go. You know, I've been walking around a lot.
Yeah.
Maybe by some miracle, I might
some
be a Spanish
miracle.
Small. Yes. Maybe I dreamt the paellas that I ate. Anyway, so I'm trying on this dress. You know when you get a dress up past your hips and that's the point of no return. Once it's past there, you have to commit. You can't take it off. You just got to commit and try it on. So I've
whittled
it
up.
It's
your dress now.
It's your dress. Just walk out with it on.
That dress is a part of you now.
Yes. Accept it as your own. Anyway, so I'm like trying on this tiny dress, right? And I really loved it and I was so excited to try it on. Trying it on and I get up past my hips and I was like, oh no, it's digging in, it's hurting. You know when you hear the seam start to split and you're like, oh no. I've created a monster.
I know it all too well.
And you hope that no one hears because you're going to be damaging your clothes.
It's like, I'd rather that be a fart.
Yes. I know you like hope that there's music playing in those change rooms so that people can't hear your shame. Anyway, so I'm like pulling it up. And I know by this stage, oh no, this is way too small. I was just so excited to try something.
It's that moment. Stop that. Oh no.
Yes. Because you know when you try things on and you think, oh, this looks small, but somehow it works. Like sometimes you think, oh wow, it's a bit stretchy, or it just somehow worked. I had hope. I was like, this might just work. This might just work. Anyway, I realized it wasn't working. And I'm getting hot, right? The aircon doesn't work. I'm sweating. Barcelona is 35 degrees. So I'm panicking, and when I panic, my body expands
and sweats more,
and I'm freaking out, right? And I'm thinking, oh my god, I just know, okay, we need to get this dress off, we need to leave. Like it went from enjoyable shopping to panic.
Exit plan.
I don't want to be here anymore. I'm not having fun anymore. I just want to go home. I'm so embarrassed already. And I was like, I'm this huge Australian that's walking to this store like with like 10 items, thinking I like run the world because I'm like, ooh, it's my shopping day. I did not run the world.
I don't want to be here anymore.
So anyway, I'm like, oh my god, I've committed to this stupid dress. It's halfway up and I freak out. So I'm trying to pull it back down, right? And I hear some more like seam splitting. I was like, oh no. Oh no. I think if any more split, I'm going to ruin this dress. It's just going to be in half, right? I'm going to tear it down the middle. So I'm like, okay, let's go the other route. Let's try and get this over my shoulders. And I'm panicking and I'm sweating. You know how you have to bend over really, like you have to literally bend, fold your body over in order to like get it past your shoulders and your head.
Yes.
Anyway, so I'm here doing that. I finally get it off. I am so joyous and happy that I got this dress off. I look at it. It's fine.
From self perspective. Ladies and gentlemen, the dress is fine.
The dress is fine. It's off. And I cannot wait to get out of there. I've got it over my shoulders and I'm like, okay, cool. Taking it off over my shoulders. I go to put my arms back down and I feel this incredible shooting pain through my shoulder that extends all the way down to my hip. And I was like, oh my God, I've pulled something trying on this dress. I've pulled something in my shoulder trying on this dress. So I can't put my arm back down. I'm not kidding. I have to stay in this change room for 5 minutes with my fucking arm up because it hurts so much. Oh my God. I know, imagine that.
Imagine you with your little arm up in the air like, ow.
It fucking hurt too. I was in so much pain. I'm sitting here in the change room like, oh my God, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. I'm stressing. I'm sweating. I'm half naked with my arm.
So raw and vulnerable.
Really perfect for this episode. So exposed. And it's hot and I'm sweating and I just don't know what to do with this goddamn arm. Eventually, I just like work it back down and I'm like, ow, this hurts. I'm trying not to cry. I'm 30 years old in Zara. Aww. Like, I'm like, don't cry. Don't cry. Be the bigger person who can. Like, you could do this. Anyways, I eventually bring my arm down and it is stinging. Like, I just had to power out of there because I was like, I'm hurting. I'm embarrassed. Aww. I'm ashamed. I think I've broken a dress. I just need to get out of here. I'm really stressed. And so, yeah, the rest of the day, I just went home and I did not feel so great about myself. And that was my trip to Spanish Zara, the most humbling experience I've ever had in a change room. And I've had quite a few. So that would be my pit, my really unfortunate run in Spanish Zara.
Honestly, that sounds so stressful.
It was.
I can imagine you after that just staring into space, like stunned, like what just happened?
Yeah. Yeah. And my arm for the next like 3 or 4 days, like shooting pain. I injured myself from trying on a dress.
Oh, you poor thing.
I mean, that's what I get.
That's so stressful. You know, we can appreciate the hilarity, but that's also very, it's very
stressful. Funny. It's pretty funny. Yeah. But the first few days after, I was like, I'm never telling anyone this. Like, this is so embarrassing. And then a week ago, I was like, I think I need to share this.
I'm
for
so
anyone.
Glad you did.
For anyone.
I'm so glad you did.
Oh, for anyone that's ever had a change room experience, I feel ya. I have had a second degree injury from a change room, so hopefully your experience is better than mine. But if you ever go overseas to European Zara, please take into account their different sizing system. Oh, gosh. Anyway, speaking of vulnerability, Ames, we are talking all things vulnerability today. Talk to me why this is an important topic.
Oh, good question. I feel like vulnerability is so important to understand. Basically for everything, I think vulnerability essentially impacts every single area of our existence as human beings. And I think there are a lot of times when we're not even aware of how vulnerability might be showing up in our lives, whether it be in relationship to ourselves, whether it might be how we are relating to other people, or even just in a macro sense, you know, so our society and culture, how vulnerability is really impacted, or how our capacity for vulnerability is impacted in a broader sense as well. What do you think, Kat?
I think vulnerability is so important to talk about. It has such a huge role in our life, our relationships, our relationship with self, and it is such an important one to touch on. So I love that, Ames. But can you give us a bit of a definition? Can you give us a bit of an idea of what vulnerability actually means?
Well, I think when we're talking about vulnerability, there are a lot of misconceptions around vulnerability. I think a lot of people may confuse vulnerability to oversharing. I think that being vulnerable is disclosing every single thing there is to know about you. And that if I'm going to be vulnerable, then I have to, you know, completely open myself to people that I know about everything about me. I think oftentimes that can be a really big misunderstanding, and that is definitely not what vulnerability is. Part of vulnerability is having boundaries. You know, vulnerability doesn't mean offering up every single detail of who you are to everyone. Vulnerability is about being able to be intentional with what you share and who you share it with, because you know yourself.
Mm.
Yeah, that's a really huge misconception that can often come up with vulnerability. I think oftentimes vulnerability really is about trust, and something that I know we'll talk a lot about around strength and bravery and that kind of thing. I know Brené Brown talks a lot about that in terms of vulnerability, but I really see vulnerability as a little bit more complex. I don't think we're aware of how vulnerable we are as human beings all of the time. I think true vulnerability is when we can really attune to what's happening internally instead of paying attention to what we are casting to the outside world. Vulnerability is essentially kind of like a fierce self-acceptance. You know, vulnerability is about our suffering, our pain. Vulnerability is believing in your own truth and deepening your own relationship to your truth. So often we are afraid of our own truth and we dread exploring it. So I think vulnerability is really about liberation, because it's a way of recognizing what is really there for self. Vulnerability is our capacity to go deep inside ourselves and really connect to ourselves and our truth. What about you, Kat? Like, what do you notice that often come up for people around misconceptions and myths around vulnerability, and how would you describe vulnerability?
Yeah, it is something that is really, it does come up often, and I wonder, because we work in clinical practice, that for us it feels like it is everywhere. But you're right, to be human is to be vulnerable. And I think vulnerability is, it's almost like saying, here I am, here's my flaws, here's my fears, here's my strengths, here's, you know, things that I don't feel lovable for, things I've been told that I'm not lovable for. And it's a risk that I'm sharing this with you. I feel like vulnerability can feel quite threatening. And so therefore, there are so many misconceptions around what vulnerability is and what it means to be vulnerable. I think first up, when we speak about vulnerability, for a lot of people, we may associate vulnerability with being weak, with not being strong, with being, you know, perhaps at risk of something. When I looked at the definition of vulnerability, it was really interesting, because the definition was the state of being exposed to the possibility of being attacked or harmed. And isn't that interesting? Because to be vulnerable is to be in danger. And when we look at vulnerability like that, of course, it makes sense why, you know, we want to be strong and put on a best front for protective reasons. So I think there's a huge misconception that to be vulnerable is to show a sign of weakness. And I think that maybe there's a lot of implications across gender, across culture. I think when we speak about vulnerability, it can create feelings of there's something wrong with it. We shouldn't be vulnerable. We need to be stoic and strong. Also, another misconception that I hear is that I shouldn't share my vulnerability, because if vulnerability equates to being weak, then what must others think of me if I'm vulnerable? You know, we are wired for connection, but for the most part, what trumps connection is safety. If we feel as though by being vulnerable and sharing these parts of ourselves, which aren't always perfect and don't always shine us in the best light, then for a lot of us, that feels too threatening. You know, we may think, well, I don't want to be rejected by other people by showing these parts of myself, so it's better if I keep it inside. And I think that creates this barrier of what you mentioned earlier, Ames, who you are on the surface, or who you are to others versus who you really are inside, and create a bit of disconnect there. And that can cause quite a lot of conflict within self. One other misconception that I see, or that I hear a lot of, is that I need to solve this on my own. I need to fix my own problems. It's nobody else's problem but my own. My own vulnerability is a weakness. It's a flaw. and there's something inherently wrong with me if I'm vulnerable, but it's something that I need to fix on my own. I think that's an incredibly interesting take on vulnerability, because it further creates this hyper-independence, this lack of connection and trust with others. Yeah, further creates I'm purely responsible for everything that is wrong or that I perceive is wrong with me, rather than challenging that idea that is there anything wrong with me? I think vulnerability is the perception as well that I'm so flawed. Nobody would love me if I was flawed. And I think that's a really powerful statement to hold if you are someone who feels like that. Do you have anything to add to some of those misconceptions? What do you see show up for you?
No, I think that you hit them all really, really well. I think when we talk about how this may show up across differing genders, cultures, and in our broader society, that is absolutely where disconnection really begins. And I think one example that is talked about a lot, and maybe not in the context of not having room for vulnerability, is around masculinity and toxic masculinity. I think there are a lot of those ideas around vulnerability being weakness and vulnerability being something that we have to hide or protect, because if we were to be vulnerable, it would leave us exposed to danger, injury, that we would be risking something. I think that is a really familiar narrative for a lot of, you know, our traditional ideas around what it means to be masculine. You know, toxic masculinity is really a result of a lot of those expectations and rules that prescribe to what being a man or being masculine should be. You know, that we're not meant to express our pain or suffering, you know, that we're not meant to seek comfort, we're meant to, you know, look after ourselves alone, that emotions are not things that we should express, you know, unless it is coming out in powerful ways like anger, you know, and that men shouldn't depend on anyone. Those types of misconceptions that can be, I guess, really evident when we look at really unhelpful ideas of what it means to be masculine. And I think in a broader sense of as well, toxic culture, you know, that this larger cultural loss, because we live in a world where we are so busy fixing and solving and figuring out what's wrong, what we need to fix about ourselves, you know, that's lacking or not good enough, that we actually lose our capacity to be completely human. We're a culture that is so based around achievement and success, rather than feel, you know, our whole humanness and get a picture of who we are as a whole, we learn that it is more valuable to be focused on our achievements and our success and how hard we are working for that external sense of value and worthiness. And this is where I think a lot of vulnerability really equates to, or we really get that sense that it's equated to weakness or a flaw or lacking, because it says something about our capacity. You know, when we live in a world where, you know, that there is a culture, a toxic culture, where, you know, we hold people in high regard who are independent, overachievers, that never need support, that can always do things independently, and we celebrate that, we're losing sight of celebrating the whole picture of what it means to be human, which is suffering and pain and struggle and imperfection. So I think that there is a lot of, I guess, shame-based narratives that really exist in this really toxic part of our culture.
Really well said. Yeah, vulnerability, you know, maybe expressing parts of ourselves that we think are wrong or not enough or things that need to be changed. And you're right, in a society where that's so celebrated, it's almost, you're right, in perpetuate cycle of shame of this thing, I'm not good enough or I need to change or fix it. But you're right, it's really undermining the whole picture of being human. We are supposed to have parts of ourselves that aren't perfect. So I love that, Aim. That's a really well put statement. I think as well, I mean, when we think about vulnerability and emotions, we always kind of, I like to look at the function of vulnerability. And I think it's an interesting one because vulnerability is not an emotion that seems adaptive on the surface. In fact, it feels incredibly threatening, like we spoke about. Vulnerability can be seen as really threatening to survival as it allows others to see weaknesses. And that might mean an increased risk of harm or someone hurting us. To be vulnerable is to be seen as less than, as weak, as not strong, as we're speaking about before. So in order to counter that, we've made ourselves strong. We've toughened up. We've hardened up and protected ourselves from being hurt. We've protected ourselves from vulnerability, and our brain is programmed to avoid pain. So it makes sense why. But when we close down our vulnerability, we shield ourselves from the hurt. But we also shield ourselves from connection. You know, the adaptive function of vulnerability, it's connection, it's love, it's deep bonds. And somewhere along the way, the need to protect ourselves from being vulnerable has been more important. Perhaps we've perceived it as more important than the need to connect. And that may also contribute as to why being vulnerable can feel so difficult to do, because it doesn't feel safe in some ways.
Absolutely. Really well said, Kat. I think this essentially really comes down to attachment versus authenticity, or how I perceive it and how I would work with clients around vulnerability, is that, like you were saying before, we are wired for empathy, for connection, for love, for compassion. And vulnerability is our capacity to connect. And as soon as you're talking about in relationships and those shields, as soon as I can show you my vulnerability, it allows you to show me yours, and we connect. And so therefore we cannot connect deeply and authentically without vulnerability, because that allows us to truly be seen. And I think it is incredible that we as humans have the capacity to feel these deep, meaningful connections, you know, for us to be able to feel our emotions. However, this requires us to be really, really equipped for a wounding environment. You know, it is not that we learn to be vulnerable. Our brain, our whole organ is wired to be vulnerable. You know, it is when our brain goes into automatic protective states of defense, like you were mentioning, Kat, shielding. You know, our brain gets really, really good at defending us from these threats and risks. You know, when we feel like we don't have the capacity to bear what rejection, shame, embarrassment, helplessness might be like. You know, so essentially you are born vulnerable. You are born with the capacity to be vulnerable. It is when your vulnerability is needing to be protected, you know, because it maybe isn't respected, validated, responded to in the way that it has needed to be. So essentially, when we're looking at attachment versus authenticity, it is our need for safety trumping our need for self. Yeah. So without attachment, we don't function. We don't live. When we're not seen with the invitation to exist, simply for being ourself, our true self, we learn that certain things are accepted and certain things are not. And when I'm talking about wounds, that's the attachment wound. So there are conditions around existing. And so we learn that, okay, well, we shut down these things that make me, I guess, more at risk, you know, more at risk of judgment, humiliation, embarrassment, not feeling good enough, rejection, abandonment, whatever we feel like we might be at risk of being exposed to. And this is really an experience of loss of psychological safety, you know, losing those tender feelings of vulnerability and being deeply understood. And then we make this really big effort not to show vulnerability. Why? Because it hasn't been safe to. And in fact, sometimes we'll then apologize for our vulnerability. You know, so this, our attachment wounds have a really significant impact on our capacity to be vulnerable. And most people are doing the best that they can. I think when we understand this with empathy and through the lens of intergenerational trauma, so for example, if you have a a mother who was the scapegoat in her family. You know, there is a betrayal, humiliation, abandonment wound, which is all stored in our implicit memory. You know, this is embedded into our nervous system and becomes a narrative of who we are. You know, in this case, someone who doesn't matter, someone who is wrong because parents have seen her or her behavior as not good enough. You know, she's essentially the black sheep of the family. She doesn't fit in. She doesn't belong here. She's wrong. That feeling of shame and fear when people who are supposed to protect you end up humiliating you when you experience criticism, all of that betrayal, humiliation, abandonment is what's stored up in that emotional, bodily, perceptual memory, also known as our implicit memory. And this is constantly priming our brain for readiness to act. When unresolved trauma memories in our implicit memory become activated, say, for example, her partner triggers that feeling of incompetence or criticism and brings up a sense of humiliation and incompetence that resonates with childhood, the mirror neurons for her will also be picking up criticism or even frustration in her partner's facial expression and body language that, you know, she's just wrong. She's incompetent. You know, why is she like this? And that triggers her own shame and humiliation and abandonment. And maybe she shuts down, maybe she numbs these feelings, or maybe she is so enraged by the attack on self that her cortex goes offline and she kind of acts out like a small child would when something feels really threatening. And this is really all a response to protect that vulnerability when perceptions of the past tell her that it's not safe to be exposed here, that it's not safe to be her authentic self here. And I think it is really essential to understand that when there is a lack of an internal, intentional, empathic presence, you know, this really, really shows up for us. You know, our mind is both in relationship and in the body. And these psychological functions, these protective mechanisms, okay, are really, one, some of our biggest teachers, yeah, but also, two, some of our biggest opportunities for correctional experiences, not only for connection with self and understanding ourselves better, but also understanding how we can be a little bit more empathic and understanding to others as well. And I know this is something that we might talk a little bit more about when we talk about what impacts our capacity to be vulnerable. But I think when we are really able to understand the whole human experience, like the whole spectrum of what it means to be human, this can really allow our broader, you know, kind of whole cultural understanding of vulnerability to shift. So, Kat, why is it important to be vulnerable, or why is it important to work on our relationship with vulnerability?
As you mentioned, Ames, vulnerability is incredibly ingrained and required for relationship, right? Being vulnerable creates emotional intimacy and connection. Opening yourself to others and your partner shows and builds trust and helps them to understand you and you them on a deeper level. As you mentioned, Ames, it's really interesting. When we are vulnerable with others, often it allows and gives permission for them to be vulnerable with us. Perhaps if we're not vulnerable with others, the other person in the relationship or the friendship or whatever it may be, it may also close down and may not feel vulnerable. A way to increase trust is to test it out. If you're someone who has typically felt as though vulnerability feels scary or threatening, or you're made to feel as though your vulnerability was disrespected or you were criticized, then it will take a little bit of time. It's not a skill you can acquire and learn overnight. If it's always felt threatening and scary, as Ames was talking about, it takes time to unlearn, and to feel safe in situations that have previously felt really unsafe and threatening. So it can also increase empathy from your partner and increase your ability to be empathic, as perhaps it's about increasing understanding of others in the relationship. It provides a much deeper, very multidimensional understanding of you and also your partner when you can be vulnerable with them. It also allows for understanding of behaviors and patterns of behavior,
when we are vulnerable, it really does show that, you know, it is felt safe for us to be vulnerable. Often patterns of behavior, for example, defensiveness is a really big one. Defensiveness is our natural mechanism to feeling vulnerable and shame and guilt, right? So when you can share, you know, your life, when you can share about what's happened for you and your relationship with vulnerability, what that can do for others around you is help to understand why you may feel defensive. You know, as Ames was speaking about with that mother, her defense, when we break it down, makes sense. But on the surface, people may not understand. And so when we're vulnerable and share perhaps how our vulnerability has shaped or been changed, it allows others around us to make sense of behaviors and to see it in a different, in a more understanding light, and vice versa. I think being vulnerable is being connected, and it is such an important part of relationships. It's almost impossible to have a deep connecting relationship with someone and not be vulnerable. I think two go hand in hand. So in order to feel connected to those around you, to feel loved, if you're someone who finds that you don't feel those connections with those around you, don't have those deeper bonds, you struggle to connect and relate to, it might be good to look into your vulnerability. Are you vulnerable with people? Do you open up? Or does it feel really unsafe to do so? I think that might be a good thing to question. So vulnerability really is our way of building really close bonds and relationships with those around us. So I think it's important. It's human. It's a really, really human side of us that I think we all need to cultivate and nurture. It's not something that comes, as Ames was saying, easily. It's something that does take time to lean into if it hasn't felt previously very safe.
Absolutely. Beautifully said. Coming up after the break, we'll be discussing what impacts our capacity to be vulnerable. Let us share some words from this episode's sponsor. Here at the Psychology Sisters, we are passionate about empowering you to have greater understanding around mental health and providing access to evidence-based information, which helps break down shame-inducing stigmas associated with psychological concerns.
If you've ever been curious about obsessive-compulsive disorder or OCD, whether it be spotting symptoms in yourself or having experiences with loved ones, everything you need to know about OCD will be right up your alley. This book is written by Dr. Lynn Drummond and Laura Edwards. Dr. Drummond is one of the UK's leading OCD psychiatrists with over 30 years' experience and numerous academic publications under her belt. Dr. Drummond has taken her years of experience and created a book aimed at the people whose lives have been affected by OCD.
Everything you need to know about OCD aims to help people advocate for their own needs in a medical setting. It also contains information on treatment options and self-help chapters on graded exposure therapy to support those who aren't able to or wanting to seek intervention. If you are interested in OCD, it can be helpful in better understanding yourself and others with symptoms and support options.
To learn more about everything OCD, visit cambridge.org/everythingOCD. We will leave all the links in the show notes for you to peruse. But for now, back to the episode. All right, Ames, what impacts our capacity to be vulnerable?
Good question. And something that popped straight into my mind with this question was a quote that I read recently, and I think it is now one of my all-time favorite quotes. I'm not sure if that's because it kind of hit something in me or because, you know, it often really rings true when I hear a lot of my clients' stories or, you know, stories from friends as well, like in this, I guess when you're in, you know, your kind of mid to late 20s or even just your 20s in general, there is just something about this quote that I think just really hits a spot. Not sure, could just be me. But the quote is, "The biggest stress of all is trying to be who you are not." And I read that a couple of times and I just thought, wow, this so speaks to the vulnerability of being your authentic self. And how distressing that can be in terms of anxiety around insecurities, fear of not being loved, accepted, approved of, and all of that, that kind of goes into figuring out who you are and connecting to your authentic self. So I love that quote. And when we talk about what impacts our capacity to be vulnerable, I think we're talking about what impacts our capacity to be our authenticity, to be our authentic self. I think a lot of this has to do with fear. You know, when we have had experiences from an early age that if we are vulnerable, we stand to lose something. So if we are ourselves, we'll lose something, whether it be safety, connection, support, whether we feel like we matter or not, whether we feel like we're special or not. So instead, what we'll do is we'll disconnect and abandon our authenticity. And often this functions to allow us to feel powerful over vulnerable for what we stand to lose. However, that doesn't get rid of the fear. It kind of keeps us stuck in these really unconscious patterns. And when we have fear around relationships due to being hurt, being abandoned, feeling shame, we close, we shut off, we disconnect from others and ourselves, or we learn to be something else. We learn to be anything we need to be to mediate these really uncomfortable experiences. So you learn to identify with something external, like I mentioned before, instead of your authenticity or your true self. So for example, think of a person in your life where you might be a yes person to, you know, where you really struggle to say no to this person. What is the fear you have around saying no? And what do you feel like this says about you if you were to say no? Because brain circuits and automatic responses such as people pleasing, for example, are triggered when we have similar experiences with people. You know, again, that implicit memory. For example, for me, I have an immensely powerful, punitive and controlling mother, and I was really scared of her as a child. So what I notice about myself as an adult is that I have a lot of fear around being myself because there's a lot of helplessness there around who I was allowed to be. So these automatic responses still come up for me when I interact with someone who is dominant and powerful, like a boss, or someone that I am really concerned with liking me or not. You know, and these brain circuits or neural networks are like habits. You know, we're not conscious of them, they just happen. So when we think about what impacts our capacity to be authentic or to be vulnerable, to be our true self, okay, it's our physiology. When you go into the world scared of being who you are, you see the world as a threat. Okay? So this changes the whole context of how we see the world that we're going into. You know, people aren't going to like me. Okay. People are going to think I'm bad or stupid or wrong. Okay. So I go into the world with this armor. And what tells me that? These neural circuits, my physiology, my stress response, my protective mechanisms. Okay. The parts of me that really care about me and that are trying to keep me safe. Okay. But the good thing about this is such a changeable intervening variable. When we learn to work with our physiology, when we learn to work with our body and calm down our nervous system, we can create really powerful change. Okay. And obviously this takes a lot of practice and a lot of work and a lot of sitting with suffering, but that's vulnerability, right? So when we're able to really be vulnerable and sit with our truth and connect to ourselves with our physiology, it changes the way we see the world. Yeah, we start to see the world with a little bit more optimism. We start to see the world as a place where we can connect. And really when we're calm, when we're in a calm physiological state, our brain is in our social engagement system. It is in that playful, spontaneous, creative state, where we're really able to go out and be our true self and be in our most, I guess, state of vitality. And that's not to say that that's easy or that we won't be scared or feel embarrassed sometimes or, you know, make mistakes. Okay. But it's about that capacity to sit with discomfort, to sit with pain, suffering and truths about ourselves. So yeah, when it comes to what impacts our capacity to be vulnerable, it is a lot, okay? It is complex. I don't think there is any one answer. But when it comes down to each person, what is, I think, And when I work with people, when I work with clients in a clinical sphere, I will work on our physiology, okay, on how I learned to be myself or what parts of myself did I have to shut down to keep myself safe.
Very well said, Ames. You're right. I think so much of the underlying fear of vulnerability comes from those core beliefs, right, of not enoughness. I'm flawed. There is something wrong with me. I need to do this or be this in order to be loved and valued. If you're someone who struggles with vulnerability, it'd be really interesting to reflect on how do you see the world? How was vulnerability modeled to you or not? What are your core beliefs around the world? Do you see the world as a threat? Do you see others as a threat? Do you see situations as a threat? Or do you see it as safety? Because likely if you've interpreted any threat in any of those domains, it will be difficult to be vulnerable because it's unsafe. Your brain, you're right, physiologically, neurologically, it's not allowing you to feel safe and therefore shutting down the ability to be vulnerable.
Oh, absolutely. It's like, again, we're not responding to exactly what's happening. We're responding to our perceptions that are embedded in our nervous system from past experiences where it hasn't been safe. And so when you feel like, you know, talking about core beliefs or core wounding, that weakness, powerless, helplessness, you know, for example, shame, I'm bad, I'm not good enough, I don't matter. When we feel small and ashamed and we go out into the world with this story, with this narrative about ourselves, okay, we send off this energy, okay, I don't matter, I will fuck up. Okay, I'm going to disappoint you and you're going to leave me. Okay. And people respond to that energy, you know, this sense of not being good enough, like, you know, and then we overcompensate, you know, so that then there's this overcompensatory behavior, you know, to prove to people that you are worthy. And then people respond to that like you're not. And so then it becomes, you know, like a perpetual pattern. You know, where you bring this energy into your interactions with people, into your relationships, and that narrative exists because, and you tell yourself, because there's something wrong with me. But it has nothing to do with there being something wrong with you. You know, we'll talk to ourselves like, why am I like this? And that's an accusing statement. It's not a question. You know, it's like, why am I still the wrong thing? You're accusing yourself. It's an attack on self. And then you're still in that state of defense. Okay. And so we go out into the world with these defenses, you know, because we want to keep ourselves safe from what we've learned that's threatening. But that defense ends up enacting what we're fearing the most, which is rejection, abandonment, being alone, feeling like we're not getting other people's approval. Yeah. And, you know, I feel like when we recognize that a lot of these experiences that happen in adulthood are based on these embedded narratives, we actually become really empowered because we can change these neural circuits. And we can talk about that a little bit later, but we can start to change how we see ourselves. You know, we're no longer these helpless children anymore. Okay. We can look after our vulnerability. We can care for our vulnerability the way that it needed when we were little. Okay. I think that is something really important when we talk about expanding our capacity to sit with vulnerability. That is absolutely not just something, you know, we might be able to do. It is something, like I mentioned, we're all born with the capacity to be vulnerable. So this is something that can definitely be worked on. Perceptions and brain circuits, like our brain is plastic. These are all things that we can work on.
Yeah, really well said, that the idea of self-fulfilling prophecy, right? If you think that you're unlovable, you will find evidence, you'll find situations to confirm that is true. And often you might over-identify or misread situations. For example, if a core belief is there is something wrong with me, I'm not worthy. If a relationship ends, for example, you may attach that, well, see, it's because I'm not worthy, and further strengthening that. And often having that belief and that way of thinking doesn't allow
for other ways of thinking of what else could have been true. And I think that's really important to take note of here. What you feel is threatening, you will find. You'll always find, right? And that will continue to strengthen unless, as Ames was saying, there's a way you can start to change that and reflect on those things and those fears. Because we spoke about that when you are growing up, your brain is developing stories and ideas and beliefs about the world around you. It doesn't just stop. It creates beliefs about, okay, well, people can hurt me as a child. People can hurt me as an adult. And so your brain will always operate on it's better to be safe than sorry. So let's put up these walls, these protective mechanisms. But ironically, as Ames was saying, you're right, those protective mechanisms are often the things that hurt us even more. And it's really difficult. It feels when you're someone who is in that or feels that you can relate to this, you feel so stuck because it's like, damned if I do, damned if I don't. So it's a really difficult thing to sit in, that feeling of people hurt me, and yet the only way to work through this or something that will help is perhaps by opening up to more hurt. And that feels so scary.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that filters in really lovely with our next question, which is, why do we struggle so much to move through and express feelings like sadness, shame, anger, embarrassment, frustration? What do you think stops us from being able to do that?
Well, these emotions are really uncomfortable. If we have attached an emotion of unsafe or threatening to them, then of course we will do everything we can to avoid them or to not process them because they feel really unsafe. When we think about these emotions, they are deemed as, and I hate this word and I wonder how you feel about this, Ames, but people say negative and positive emotions. This may be deemed as, quote, negative emotions, but are they negative or are they just uncomfortable? I think perhaps we attach this label of I shouldn't be feeling like this or this is scary, but it may just be discomfort. And being vulnerable is sitting in discomfort. It's acknowledging that these feelings are there. You can sit in them and you can make space for them. And it doesn't feel as overwhelming the more that you can sit in them. It doesn't feel as scary. By not being vulnerable, you continue to avoid these feelings. You know, as we spoke about, if you fear that you'll be rejected in relationships, you will probably try to avoid rejection where you can. And so therefore, we struggle to move through them because they're so uncomfortable. They feel so uncomfortable and feel so much scarier than actually being in them. And if you've ever felt sadness, shame, helplessness, etc. in childhood, perhaps there was some helplessness. Perhaps you didn't know what to do with them. You know, they're really big emotions to feel. And so that can carry through in adulthood of, well, I don't know what to do with this. This feels scary and I don't know how to soothe. I don't know how to work through these emotions. So I want to avoid them because they're too much. So we struggle to move through emotions that are typically really uncomfortable because sitting in them is a lot. It feels too scary. So I think that for those who, if you notice that you're someone who does struggle to sit in, express feelings, be, as Ames was saying, your authentic self, or just be able to open up about parts of you that you've not shared with anyone else, I wonder if it's how that sits with you. I wonder if that actually feels really uncomfortable, even the thought of talking about something about you. What comes up for you? How is your body responding to that? Because I wonder if that discomfort is almost kind of talking you off the ledge before you have a chance to give it a go and to jump. So I would say that we struggle to move through these emotions because of how it makes us feel. And often a lot of the work that I'm sure Ames does and that I do is sitting in that feeling, acknowledging that feeling, validating that feeling, creating safety around that feeling.
Absolutely. Beautifully said. I think also what comes up for why we might struggle to move through discomfort, and I agree, I think sometimes there is a lot of stigma around the term negative emotions. I think the term negative emotions is used to describe the physiological and psychological experience. Yeah, but absolutely, it is an experience of discomfort or pain. And I think oftentimes we struggle to sit in discomfort when we are really disconnected from ourselves, when we're really unable to have that deeper understanding of our internal experience. And often that is because we haven't had somebody be that empathic presence to us. And so we really struggle to have that gentle inquiring curiosity, to have that compassion towards ourselves that helps us see our truth. You know, when we recognize that our relationships with ourselves are based off our perceptions of the past, for example, when was the first time you were really angry and how were you responded to? Or when was the first time, you know, and I don't mean to say when was the first time, you know, on this date or in this year, but, you know, kind of like when were your formative experiences of sitting with discomfort and how were you responded to? You know, what is the story you have around yourself when you feel these emotions? Like when you're angry, does it make you a bad person? You know, when you're sad, do you feel like it makes you weak? When you feel shame, does it make you feel like you're not deserving, you're not worthy? You know, and what kind of person is an undeserving, unworthy person? Okay, well, it doesn't really make me want to go out into the world and connect with people. If you assume that you are deserving because you have this compassionate, empathic curiosity about yourself, your brain jumps to a completely different narrative. So healing and being vulnerable allows us to see, I guess, this compassionate, empowering source within us that allows us to really hold discomfort and respond to it with, I guess, what it needs, which is understanding. You know, even when we think about being triggered, I always find this really interesting to explore with clients because triggered is a word that comes up so much. Like, Kat, you probably hear this all the time too. I'm triggered. I'm triggered. Mm-hmm. Okay. What is a trigger really? Like when you say you're triggered, what is a trigger? When you perceive yourself to be triggered, who's holding the weaponry? Is it your own mechanism? Are you the one pulling the trigger? Because oftentimes we mistake triggers for understanding our response to others. But really, this is about understanding what is exploding inside us. Oftentimes it's very natural, like Kat was saying, we want to avoid discomfort. And a lot of avoiding discomfort is around denial, defense, and blame. Okay, but when we're really understanding triggers and how we diffuse it, it's about really getting to know ourselves rather than closing and disconnecting. And there's no blame here because it's not deliberate. It's unconscious. You know, you don't blame people for having unconscious patterns, but you do try your best to bring awareness around this because these unconscious patterns are passed on intergenerationally and they have an impact on our physiology. And that's kind of what drives change. So we need to get conscious. Without vulnerability, we are not response able, meaning we don't have the capacity to respond to ourselves. And so instead, we go on recreating these unconscious patterns unintentionally. And then we say, I'm triggered. Okay. I can't sit with my anger. I can't sit with my sadness. I'm triggered. Mm-hmm. And I need to fix it. I need to fix what's wrong with me. Why am I like this? I've got to fix it. Without being able to kind of sit with that real truth. Yeah. Our authenticity, having that compassionate curiosity. I think that's a lot of the reason or that I see in why we struggle so much with discomfort.
Mm, yeah, really well said. And I think going into tips to be more vulnerable, if you're listening to this and you're thinking, okay, oh my gosh, I feel like I perhaps feel the disconnect or feel...
What is vulnerability?
SOS. If you're thinking, okay, well, perhaps I do feel disconnected. Perhaps there is a pattern within my relationships or within my behavior, which suggests that I struggle with vulnerability. As Ames was speaking about, it's going back to where you learnt about emotions. How was expression of emotions received? When you were growing up, how was your expression of sadness, anger, or the quote negative emotions perceived? Because if they were perceived in a way that was loving and nurturing and responsive and caring, you may feel you have greater capacity to be vulnerable. To be vulnerable may not feel as scary for you. But if
those expressions of emotion were different to that, if they were critical, if they were shut down, if they were dismissed, then I wonder if that you may find it much more threatening to be vulnerable, because to be vulnerable means to lose connection with those who love us. So I think when we speak about how to be more vulnerable, I would always recommend, and we always say this, Ames, but go back to where it all began. Where did you learn about vulnerability? How was your vulnerability received growing up? And where did you learn, you know, about your feelings and your quote negative emotions? I think that's a really good place to reflect on and to start, because we can provide lots of surface strategies, but without knowing where it's all come from and the function, it's really hard to change. And I think when we go back to the function, if it was protective, it increases our ability to be compassionate. Well, of course I shut down because that was scary for me as a kid. If we think, oh, I find it hard to open up and I don't know why, we just perpetuate that cycle of criticism. Whereas when we look and increase our understanding and think, well, it makes sense, because to be vulnerable was to be scared. To be vulnerable was to be shut down and dismissed by someone. So of course that's showing up for me now. That's a really powerful thing to learn and to understand about yourself, that probably that you're in a, or your difficulty to be vulnerable has probably been just your very clever brain protecting you from anything that felt threatening. So having kind of that reflection can be helpful if you do notice that you struggle with being open and vulnerable. The only other thing I was going to add to that was, we spoke about acknowledgement of feelings. So if you're someone who does struggle with vulnerability, it can be really helpful to take some time to acknowledge difficult emotions. So notice if there are certain emotions, situations that trigger that physiological response. If you feel uncomfortable, if you feel like you want to shut down, it's a really good time to take note of what those emotions were and practice sitting in those. Acknowledging emotions can comprise of two different parts: observing them and validating them. So observing your emotions is almost like thinking of your emotions as separate to you and being a curious observer on the outside. Observing your anger means watching it without thinking about what it means or what you need to do about it. Observing your anxiety means simply noticing it instead of elaborating on it with worries or criticizing yourself for feeling it. Observing your sadness means describing what it feels like instead of judging it or interpreting it in a way that felt, you know, that you were critical of self for being sad. Observing your emotion could be as simple as noticing how it feels in your body, or literally just saying to yourself, I'm feeling really sad right now. If you find it difficult to be vulnerable, practice self-validation within self first. Increase that feeling and sense of safety within self. Validating your emotion is the second part, which can be helpful. And it's just reminding yourself that it's okay to feel however you're feeling. There is no right or wrong with emotions. The feelings police don't come and knock on your door and tell you that you shouldn't be feeling that emotion. You might not enjoy feeling frustrated, but it's okay that you feel like that. You might prefer to be happy and positive and not feel any uncomfortable emotions, but it's normal and it's okay to feel any of those uncomfortable or quote negative emotions. Sometimes if you struggle with this, practicing safety within self, self-validation and self, you know, identification of those emotions and sitting in the discomfort can be a really good place to start. And if you, you know, Ames and I always say, you know, it can be good to practice with a therapist as well. To come to therapy, I think within itself is quite an act of vulnerability. So I think those are just a few things that could be helpful. Ames, what have you got to add to that?
Beautiful practical tips. I love those. I agree. I think using a beautiful, curious, compassionate inquiry is a wonderful way to unveil a level of consciousness around vulnerability or vulnerable parts that we might have disconnected from. I also really want to preface that if you are someone who is quite disconnected from self and vulnerability feels really threatening and scary, this will be really, really challenging. And so it's okay if you don't know how you feel. If you are someone that has learned to shut down your feelings and switch off your emotions and your needs to keep yourself safe, this is going to be really challenging. And so it is very similar to going to the gym. I always like to say it is kind of like working out for your brain. Even if you just give yourself 1 minute a day to drop in to what is feelable. And even if what is feelable is that this feels dumb, it feels really dumb to acknowledge my feelings. It feels really stupid to sit with myself. That's okay. You know, acknowledging that part of you that believes sitting with yourself and giving yourself emotional space is stupid, and starting to notice if you can expand your capacity for compassion here, to be present with that part of you that is giving yourself space for the discomfort and pain or frustration that might come up here. And that's another really common experience for people. I think that's actually another thing to note here as well, is this is not about thinking. This is about feeling. When we are talking about reconnecting with vulnerable parts of ourselves, we're talking about having an embodied, feelable experience. So like Kat said, noticing what this feels like in my body and really being able to connect to what is feelable, even if it is the frustration of stuckness that I don't know how I feel. And it feels like I just want it to stop. I just want this 1 minute or 30 seconds of sitting with myself to stop and be over so I can go back to distraction, because that's where I feel comfortable and familiar and safe. Okay, just starting to recognize and notice this with some compassionate inquiry. Okay, so curiosity around what this is like for me when I notice this is a really, really wonderful start to strengthen those new neural networks, to strengthen those parts of our brain that are wired for safety and connection, as opposed to the old networks that were wired for protection, that keep you shut down, that keep you disconnected. Another term that I will use a lot with clients is interoception. So this is a process where our nervous system senses and integrates signals from our body. Essentially, again, what is feelable, what's embodied, because oftentimes these are unconscious states that, like we mentioned, really impact our capacity to feel vulnerable and safe and authentic and how we see the world. Okay, so having this, I guess, practice again with our body and noticing what calm states feel like and how that will feel in your body. So, you know, noticing your breaths, your heart rate, and then noticing what states of discomfort, fear, stress, anger feel like in your body. Sorry if you can hear Mowgli having a little shake. And I guess really creating safety to see value in these physiological states. So noticing that this is a signal for unmet needs with an internalized narrative of not being worthy. However, when I feel like this is actually a really wonderful protective part of me that has kept me really safe. And when I honor this part of me as a protection, okay, when I honor my body and respect my body for keeping me safe, you know, I can also hold myself accountable and worthy enough to meet my own needs now. Okay, so again, this is not easy work at all, and I would recommend doing this work with a therapist. I think, Kat, that was such a beautiful statement that therapy is such a powerful act of vulnerability. Completely agree there. But I think when we are going near parts of ourselves that maybe haven't been held or that feel really scary to go near, it can be quite transformative for those parts to be held by someone that has an empathic presence to give you that correctional experience.
Well said, Ames. We are always very over time for our podcast.
Yes.
Thank you so much for joining us, guys. If you got this far, we hope we have provided some clarity and support and understanding into vulnerability. As always, if you want to learn more, we are on Instagram at The Psychology Sisters and The Psych Collaborative. Thank you so much for tuning in, Ames. Thank you for your beautiful, wise wisdom. And thank you for just being a lovely ray of sunshine.
Oh, stop. Right back at you, sister. Thank you always for your expertise, the lols, the change room story really made my day.
The dog poo.
the dog poo
really made mine. All right, guys, we will be back. I'm back now, so we'll have a bit more consistency. We will be back in a few weeks with an exciting interview, actually. So we are very much looking forward to that. Bye.
Bye. Thanks so much for tuning in to today's episode. If you're not already, please follow us on Instagram at The Psychology Sisters. We are also now providing online psychological sessions. For more information, please follow us at The Psych Collaborative. See you next time.